It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, a new music festival designed to highlight the growing hip-hop scene in Des Moines. But first, Deborah Marquardt is a poet, musician, memoirist, and short story writer. She's also a professor of English at Iowa State University. And her most recent poetry collection is called Small Buried Things. And she is here with me now. Hello, Deb.
Hi, Charity. It's great to see you.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you here. And this is a collection of poetry that you've just released. It's been quite a while since you've released a poetry collection. This is your third overall, but it's been since 2002. What made this the right time?
I had just finished up a couple big research nonfiction projects, and the poems had been kind of dribbling in one by one. They often come in the cracks of things, especially during the school year when I'm too busy to work on long, intensive, nonfiction projects. And so I think it's the same thing that happened with my last collection from Sweetness. I just looked at the file and I thought, oh, it's getting kind of thick. I better look and see what's in the file of poems. And then when I began to look at them, I could see that they had these connections and correspondences and kind of echoes and patterns that I hadn't really planned when writing them individually, but that's what usually happens when you write poems over the course of 5 or 6 years.
What makes an idea a poem for you as opposed to one of the many other things that you do in writing short stories and writing nonfiction, writing music? What makes it a poem?
Well, it usually happens for me in the development of the piece. It usually comes as an idea. You know, often it begins with an image or some kind of a memory. And I have a notebook where I just store all these things, kind of a warehouse notebook. And then when I sit down to write, I can start to see that it's a poem when I look at the shape of it, the way it feels. Poems often have condensed down language. They often resist going into forms like sentences. They often come in lists and sort of flourishes of details and images. And so that's usually when I know I have a poem. But, you know, in the initial phases when you're sort of walking through your daily life and you see something, I think that's when most writers have a sense of when there's something coming that's going to be a thing to write about. And for me, it's an image that won't go away, and then it makes itself into its way into my notebook. You know, like I have some poems in the collection where one of them, I went to the Parks Library to look up the word husband in the Oxford English Dictionary. And when I got there, the word had been torn out, the page had been torn out of the Oxford English Dictionary. So I immediately knew that was a poem. But it didn't become a poem for many years. I just put it in my notebook, and then one day it kind of blossomed.
And you assumed that whoever had torn out that page before you had also gone to the library to look up the word husband.
For true meanings of the word, yes. And it had been replaced, I could see, by a librarian. So it was photocopy, grainy photocopy, and it had been taped in. But I could see the damage that had been done in some previous years. So that became a poem. Or the poem you were talking about, Things Not to Put in Your Mouth, was a medical exhibit in Des Moines. And when I saw it, I immediately knew it was a poem. But it took me, I would say, maybe 10 years to actually write it,
Would you read that one for us, Things Not to Put in Your Mouth?
Yes, this is my Iowa poem. I'm so proud of it. I went to the medical display in Iowa State Historical Museum. It's a display of Dr. James Downing's many years as an ear, nose, and throat specialist. So this was the medical display. A penny, a quarter, a button, a paper clip, safety pins closed and open, most ingested while changing diapers. In two shadow boxes, Dr. James Downing displayed the objects he'd extracted from patients' food and air passages between 1929 and 1956. A wishbone, a kernel of corn over large, a pen nib, beads from a necklace with a string still attached, a nail, a screw, a cover from a bottle of Anacin. Thumbtacked in rows, suspended in glassine envelopes, these objects floated in glass cases, a warning about things not to put in your mouth. A toothpick, a rhinestone earring, a wadded-up ball of paper, a metal snap, a cucklebur seed, spiky as a porcupine, a long sewing needle, a sardine can turnkey, many small chicken bones, things with sharp edges, cumbersome things that get caught in the throat, things that go down hard and refuse to come up, a Daughters of the American Revolution pendant, a gold hinge from a jewelry box, a price tag marked 89 cents for item number 102593 from the Yonkers department store. The exhibit includes the doctor's leather medical bag and his instruments of extraction, a tracheal dilator, a uvula dilator, laryngeal and esophageal forceps, along with a humorous note jotted in a hospital report. Feed her anything but nickels and pennies, the report reads, beside the nickel extracted from the child's throat.
That's Deborah Marquardt reading from the poem Things Not to Put in Your Mouth from her new collection, Small Buried Things. And that poem is kind of an outlier in the book. You have a few poems that are similar to that in that they were clearly inspired by something you saw or visiting a museum, traveling, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But much of the poetry in the collection seems autobiographical, is it?
Yeah, I think poems always, I always say that every poem should have a drop of your own blood in it, and some of them have a few more than a few drops of your own blood in them. And so I think in order for me to write a poem, I have to have an emotional investment in it. And so even the poems like this one, in which I went to a medical, you know, a state historical museum display and got an idea for a poem, I'm somehow, you know, telling the story through my own lens of experience. So I started to think about this poem as a central poem to the collection when I thought about small buried things. And, you know, these are the things that one has been carrying around for many years. They're small, slight memories of things that happened, and they won't go away. And the poem serves for me kind of as a, like the medical objects at the end of the poem, the uvula dilator and the laryngeal and esophageal forceps that sort of go in deep and extract these things. So then that poem began to become a central metaphor for the entire collection.
Does extracting these memories through poetry, is it a kind of therapy for you?
I think writing is often therapy. You know, I teach in a creative writing program, and so we often ask our students to dig deep in experience and into memory, and it often goes into painful things. And, you know, the outcomes are always different. I mean, sometimes digging in too deep at the wrong time in one's life can lead to other kinds of problems. So I would hesitate to say I'm not a medical professional, but I do have an undergrad degree in social work, and I sometimes think that that's, you know, served me over the years. But I think, you know, the individual writer has to understand how deep he or she can go at the time when working on a piece of writing.
The poems that you write that seem autobiographical, that tell us stories from your past, or at least convey a little tiny piece of a story, but give us an emotion from your past, They seem like they would make you very vulnerable. Is it hard to put these, not just on paper, I mean, writing them is one thing, is it hard to publish and think everybody's going to get this glimpse into where I've been and how I feel?
It used to be so much easier because, you know, the poems would go to these obscure literary journals and no one would really read them. And certainly no one from my family. But and in the beginning, you know, I would send my books home, but my parents weren't big readers of literary work. My mother, you know, likes to read Prevention magazine and things like that. But I think after my memoir was published, people began paying more attention. And so it is more of an issue, but I always feel it's the writer's obligation to write as honestly as possible, and also to, you know, render oneself in the page as honestly as possible. And if you've done that, I think people will give you a break. You know, I did have an incident in a small town in North Dakota where like the whole town read my memoir, and they were really mad at me. And I showed up, and they were, as I say in the book, you know, standing at the city gate with pitchforks and burning torches. But I sat in the library with them for about 3 hours that night, and by the end of the conversation, I felt that they understood a bit more of what I was writing about and were less mad at me. So,
and for people who haven't read your memoir, what were they angry about?
I think they only read half of it because, no, that's not, I'm sure some people did read all of it, but the memoir, The Horizontal World, is a kind of, it's about a low-grade feud that I had with my home state for many, many years, and I couldn't understand it, why I kind of didn't want to go back there even to visit, but the place wouldn't let me go. And I thought that tension was very interesting, and so I wanted to write into it to try to understand what it was about the place that had such a powerful hold on me. And in the end, it was a real love letter to the state.
And you write about, in this poetry collection, you have a number of poems that really express a lot of affection and also concern for your home state of North Dakota.
Yeah, I feel an obligation to continue to write about my home state. It's the place that imprinted itself on me when I was very young. And so I still consider myself a North Dakotan, even though I've lived in Iowa since 1991. And so much of my material goes back to my home state. And of course, in the last 10 years, there's been a huge, set of events with the oil boom that's going on in my home state. And so it's complicated, but it's something I've felt compelled to write about, yes.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Deborah Marcourt. She is a poet, a musician, a memoirist, a short story writer. She's also a professor of English at Iowa State University and has taught many other places as well. Her most recent collection of poems is called Small Buried Things. And we will continue our conversation in just a moment. Also, later on this hour, we'll get a preview of the first hip-hop festival in the state of Iowa coming this August. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me right now is Deborah Marcourt. Her most recent collection of poetry is called Small Buried Things. And Deb, just before the break, we were talking about how you, of course, your memoir was all about growing up in North Dakota and your conflicted relationship with the state of North Dakota. You write a lot about North Dakota in your poetry as well. And one of the things that struck me was, of course, that you grew up during the Cold War, and North Dakota was a place where there were missile silos. You grew up thinking that if there was a nuclear holocaust, you would be at the center of it.
That's right. I think many people believed they were at ground zero, but we definitely believed that in North Dakota. I don't know if many people know that there were thousands of ICBMs in the state of North Dakota, buried in the farmland, mostly along the northern sort of half of the state. And I wrote this for the collection. It's actually the title poem of the collection, Small Buried Things. I wrote a sequence of poems about this kind of complicated history of land use in the state. In particular, it started with this kind of fear I had as a child that, I knew that those ICBMs were up there. And if there were nuclear war, we were going to be ground zero. And then I began doing research on it, and I understood the structure of the ICBMs, the way they were administered. And then I got even kind of more scared because, there were these missileers who their job was to go deep, deep into the ground and memorize launch codes. And they would go down in these missile caverns underneath these command centers, and they controlled sort of 10 missiles at a time. And so this was going on, imagine, sort of all throughout the Cold War, really unbeknownst to many people living on the sort of top side of the landscape.
And you also imagine what it must have been like to be stationed in North Dakota. You share an echo of someone saying, only the best and brightest get sent to North Dakota. But yeah, you suspect that's not the case.
No, it's not. I just recently was traveling through North Dakota and did some reading of this book. and was approached by some children, actually, of Missileers who in Minot, North Dakota, which is there's a big air base there. And they talked about kind of the loneliness of the work and that these Missileers would have to go deep in these caverns and stay for long shifts. And it was very, very sort of devastating work, but they did it for our protection. And actually, one of the things that happened when I was researching this was my alarming discovery that there are still approximately 150 currently commissioned ICBMs that are still up there in North Dakota, planted right inside the fracking zone, which I found alarming as a citizen. And I ended up writing about that, too, in the collection.
Well, and you you write quite a bit about fracking, and I'd love for you to read your poem, Lament. But for people who may not know very much about North Dakota, I guess we know that there's this oil boom. We know that there are lots of jobs in North Dakota, more jobs than there are places for people to live, and the pay is good, but there are downsides to this boom as well. And you're very concerned about the fracking going on.
I am. I was invited by the Humanities Council to travel up in North Dakota for two-month blocks a couple times in the last few years. So I went to small communities impacted by the boom and taught creative writing workshops. So I've had many conversations with people who are have lived on the land for generations and people who have just moved into work on the boom. So there's not really a good guy, bad guy story here at all. It just has to do with the complexities of economics and the complexities of the extraction industry, in particular oil, which is a very dirty industry. So as I was doing all this work and writing these poems, you know, there were events going on. Like in September of 2013, there was this big pipeline break that occurred in Tioga, North Dakota. Something like, 865,000 gallons of oil that emptied out into a farmer's field. And so, you know, that happened in 2013. And it impacted 30 acres of land, and they're still cleaning it up. And so there were a series of these pipeline breaks and oil spills. And I think there was a recent Duke University study that indicated there have been something like 3,900 spills, many of them major, some of them minor, that have occurred in North Dakota during the oil boom. So it's hard to know how all these projects are going to be remediated. All of these are very, very expensive, cleanup projects. So I wrote this sequence of poems, and then it culminates in this poem, Lament. Should I go ahead and read
yeah.
it? Yeah. Okay. Lament. North Dakota, I'm worried about you. The companies you keep, all these new friends, North Dakota, beyond the boom, beyond the extraction of precious resources, do you think they care what becomes of you? North Dakota, you used to be the shy one, enchanted secret land loved by only a few. North Dakota, when I traveled away and told people I belonged to you, North Dakota, your name rolled awkwardly from their tongues. A mouthful of rocks, the name of a foreign country. North Dakota, you were the blushing wallflower, the natural beauty nearly invisible, always on the periphery. North Dakota, the least visited state in the Union. Now, everyone knows your name, North Dakota. The blogs and all the papers are talking about you, even 60 Minutes. I'm collecting your clippings, North Dakota, the pictures of you from space, the flare-ups in your northern corner, like an exploding supernova, a massive city where no city exists, a giant red blight upon the land. And those puncture wounds, North Dakota, take care of yourself. The injection sites, I see them on the maps, thousands of active wells, one every 2 miles. All your indicators are up, North Dakota. 400 billion barrels, some estimates say. More oil than we have water to extract. More oil than we have air to burn. North Dakota, you could run the table right now. You could write your own ticket. So, how can I tell you this, North Dakota? Your politicians are co-opted, or cowards, or bought out, or honest and thwarted. They're lowering the tax rate for oil companies. They're greasing the wheels that need no greasing. They're practically giving the water away. They have opened you up and said, come in, take everything. North Dakota, dear sleeping beauty, please wake up. What will become of your sacred places? What will become of the prairie dog, the wolf, the wild horses, the eagle, the meadowlark, the fox, the elk, the pronghorn antelope, the rare mountain lion, the roads, the air, the topsoil, your people? What will become of the water? North Dakota, who will ever be able to live with you once this is all over? I'm speaking to you now as one wildcat girl to another. Be careful, North Dakota.
That's Lament, a poem in the new collection, Small Buried Things by Deborah Marquardt. I can imagine that if you did a reading in North Dakota, there might be some people upset at the coffee house or the library or the bookstore. You're wading into political territory that I'm sure people have really strong emotions about.
Well, you know, this is a heavily researched poem. I recently did a presentation, and it's an hour-long PowerPoint, and I have all the documentation on all of these items. Practically every line from this poem comes from some piece of research. The reference to the giant red blight upon the land was actually a NASA photograph where you could see the Bakken from space, and it looks like a major metropolitan area. And so I felt that the poem is pretty solidly grounded in research. And, you know, again, I don't really approach the writing of these pieces as a kind of good guy, bad guy.
Right.
It has to do with how complex the extraction industry is. And the larger questions about the way that politicians should really be the ones to sift through these things and weigh all of the factors and make the best decisions for the population. Because there are many small micro arguments that can be made about local economies and, you know, bringing jobs versus public safety versus, you know, seizing land, you know, for the public good. But I think, you know, this should go back to our, you know, our politicians and these protection agencies that should really come in, because they have the large picture about just exactly, for example, how much remediation money is necessary to clean up even the smallest spill. So it is dangerous water, I imagine. And when I wrote that line, your politicians are co-opted, or, you know, I tried to have a variety of options there, because I've seen in the state of North Dakota that there are politicians who are very honest, but they have been thwarted. The oil industry is a very powerful industry. They have a lot of money at their disposal. So they make very persuasive arguments.
I think I first met you in probably 1994 or 1995, and you struck me as a very brave individual back then. And then reading these poems, it feels like with age, you have become even braver. You have less reserve about sharing yourself and speaking your mind. Am I right?
I think it's the times. Things have gotten very intense, and watching this occur for the last 10 years in my home state, and I'm working on a longer research nonfiction piece about this oil boom in my home state, but I write in that piece that I go home as if I'm going home to attend to a family member who's dying. That's not to say the state is dying. I mean, it's a really dynamic situation. There are a lot of good things about the oil boom in my home state. There's a part of the state that's paying dearly. In fact, I think they're despairing. They feel that they have been declared an energy sacrifice zone. The rest of the country doesn't really care what happens to them, the place that they live, what their land will be like, what their water will be like. So, you know, I feel an obligation as a writer and a person of conscience, you know, and someone who really loves that place, to speak up for it. And like I said, it's almost as if someone in my family is gravely ill, and I have to rush back to attend to that them.
We've touched on some really difficult, heavy subjects. Your poetry also, some of it is very funny and very relatable. I would love for you to read Whisker Meditations for us.
Okay, well, this is a little poem in parts, and I wrote it when I realized I had this little, oh, it's just a terrible little personal secret, but I had a little whisker that kept popping up, and I thought,
well, on your chin.
That's right. Yeah. So this is Whisker Meditation, and it's kind of all the things that I collected that I realized I knew about whiskers. Whisker Meditations 1. When I told my fiancé's mother about my persistent recurring whisker, lower right, underside of my chin, she smiled sideways, said, "Be glad it's only one." 2. I was parked in the lot outside Bed Bath & Beyond with my then-husband. I was applying lipstick in the mirror the first time I spotted it, my whisker enjoying a stretch of unchecked growth. It was hot in the car. We were laughing. My husband tried to tweeze it out with his fingertips. When that failed, he offered to tweeze it with his teeth. What an act of extreme devotion. It makes me wonder why I ever let him go. 3. It begins a smooth bump on the skin that you must worry for days with your fingertips, then a small nub, slight friction in the follicle, nothing visible. Hours pass, days, you forget. Then, one day, you catch it in silhouette or sunlight. A long tendril, like a pliable scrap of piano wire, sprung from your chin. 4. My friend Jenny tells me about one night after she and Colin made love, lying there, sweaty, happy. Colin spotted a long brown hair on Jenny's skin. His hair, he thought. When he tried to pick it off, the skin lifted. The follicle resisted. It was connected. "Get it off me!" Jenny screamed. "Get it off!" 5. This sliver of iron ore spun from the lava core of the earth, one thin chin wire rising through Cambrian, Devonian, up through continental shelves, bedrock, shale, topsoil, this tendril, manganese, copper, platinum, must have pierced my heel, threaded my first step, wound around tendons up shin, thigh, groin, traveled through heart, breast, throat, to arrive here on my chin in my 40th year. 6. Sometimes in meetings at work, I catch myself stroking my sad whisker while contemplating problems. I better understand now the gestures of my bearded colleagues who, over the years, have cradled their chins, stroked with the grain, against the grain, or, when really perplexed, vigorously scratched a stubbled cheek. 7. In the bathroom of a 4-star hotel, marble shower, terrazzo floors, I turn on the lighted magnifying mirror hanging near the vanity. Never mind crow's feet, enlarged pores, the natural exigencies of age, but oh, in the magnifying glass, under that terrifying light, constellations of age spots, catastrophe of eyebrows, oh, whisker. All the while my fiancé is knocking on the frosted glass door. What are you doing in there? 8. And now my whisker has attracted an evil albino twin, emerging from the doorway of the neighboring poor. How long will it be before the rest of the family arrives? The older cousins, the in-laws, the parents, not to mention the car full of California cousins. 9. To pluck it, you must stand by the window, blinds open in full light, with a tweezer and a hand mirror. Try to tuck yourself behind the billow of the curtain. No need for you to star in a YouTube video titled, "My Crazy Old Neighbor Lady Plucks Her Whisker Again." And 10. You'll never get it on the first try, or the second. You have to poke around. Then one day, the tweezer's edge will land, small suction as the follicle releases. When it happens to me, I hold the whisker up in the light, say, "Got it, you whisker." A small moment of satisfaction, followed by silence, vacuous air, contemplating the many hours and days, the many weeks it will take for this grave act to be undone.
Deborah Marquardt reading from her collection, Small Buried Things. Deb, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Charity. It was so great to talk with you.
Deborah Marquardt is an English professor at Iowa State University. Again, her most recent collection of poetry is called Small Buried Things. Coming up in just a moment, we'll get a preview of a new music festival that will be taking place in Des Moines this August. It will be the first hip-hop festival in the state. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.